This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Black and Brown students at Philadelphia's Temple University hold an all-day conference on Black Panther Party co-founder Huey P. Newton and the struggle for world peace and self-determination. And a New York City DJ reports on 10 days she spent among the people of Palestine under Israeli military occupation. But first, Dr. Johnny Williams, a professor of sociology at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, has been put on a leave of absence in the wake of organized white protests against a statement he posted on social media this summer. Dr. Williams was angry over police killings of Black people. He'd recently read a post by someone that called himself Son of Baldwin, who titled his piece, Let Them Effing Die.
It dealt with what if we did the same thing that racial bigots did to us. That is, if we saw them bleeding and they in need of help, what if we just walk away and showed indifference like they do us? Like they did with Mike Brown, and after they shot him and left him in the street forever, with Eric Garner in New York, after he said he couldn't breathe so many times. What if we just ignored them? And he said that would totally discombobulate them, because we don't center them anymore. We don't think about their whiteness as being important anymore. We center ourselves. And so there was a conversation going on Black Twitter. I used the hashtag Let Them Die when I posted my statement. And what I said was, this is it verbatim, the first tweet post, Facebook post, was, it is past time for racially oppressed to do what people who believe themselves to be white will not do, put an end to the vectors of the destructive mythology of whiteness and their white supremacy. Hashtag let them fucking die. And what I'm referring to in let them fucking die, and this was June 18th, is whiteness and white supremacy. That's what I'm referring to. And then shortly after that particular post, I did another one. This is what I said. I said, it is past time for the racially oppressed to do what people who believe themselves to be white will not do, put an end to the vectors of the destructive mythology of whiteness and their white supremacy system. And I used the hashtag, let them fucking die. And that was referring to whiteness and white supremacy. But that was misconstrued by the people who head up campus reform who went trolling for me. But then I wrote, shortly after I put that post up on Facebook and Twitter, I did another one on the 18th, June 18th. I said, I'm fed the fuck with the self-identified whites' daily violence directed at immigrants, Muslims, and sexually and racially oppressed people. The time is now to confront these inhuman assholes and end this now. And so they picked it up and they put it that I was calling for violence against white people and just to let them die. And the Washington Times shortly picked it up, which is a conservative newspaper in Washington, D.C., and they just totally misconstrued even further what was being said, and said that I was talking about this Congressman Scalise, which I wasn't. I was talking about whiteness and white supremacy. So what they did was basically whistleblow, I think, to their base, their racist base. And so I didn't find out what was going on until a reporter from RealClearLife.com called me and said, what are your comments about what Campus Reform is saying? And I said, who is Campus Reform? I'd never heard of them. And she said, well, this is what they said you said. I go, no, I didn't say that. I never said that. And she told me that she's going to try to write a story to correct this. But then her editors said they didn't want to get involved because it was all just hearsay and rumor and it wasn't true. So they didn't get involved. But then the college itself, Trinity College where I work, started to receive phone calls. They had about 60 phone calls coming in every minute, I guess, something like that. So crashing the system. The Facebook page was overloaded with all kinds of racist kind of comments, so they had to shut that down. They shut down their Twitter account also because of that. And then some of the threats that they said that they just did abundant of caution to shut the school down for half a day. It wasn't a whole day, half a day.
This sounds like an orchestrated campaign.
It is an orchestrated campaign. Yes, it is. This has been going on now for over 2-3 decades. especially directed at scholars of color, especially those who deal with Palestine, as well as now with Black Lives Matter, which, as you know, the FBI says that the movement for Black Lives is loaded with Black extremist identity, something like that. And so they're coming after folk who are trying to challenge white supremacy as a system, and the people who depend on white supremacy to give them their license, their white license. I don't use the word privilege so much as white license, because people who think that they are white authorize the authorities who are sustaining white supremacy to continue it. So this is about white license, and that's what they're doing. And the police is involved in it, the mass incarcerated state, as Michelle Alexander points out in her book, New Jim Crow. All this stuff has been going on for decades, and now it's come to its fruition with the election of Donald Trump. These people, they're actually coming out, and they're unafraid to hide in the shadows anymore, so they're just being very open about it, and they're coming after people who challenge them and disagree with what they're doing and their inhumanity.
And yeah. This group, Campus Reform, claims to defend free speech, but it appears to be doing exactly the opposite.
Exactly. I mean, at colleges, it's not a question of free speech. It's a question of academic freedom. They're using free speech, and this is an old kind of tactic that was used back in the 1940s with the rise of these new Nazis, these fascists who come and talk about they're trying to have their say, and so they have a right to say what they say. But the fact is that there are limits to free speech. I mean, if free speech incites violence that they're doing, they're calling for violence and ethnic cleansing and stuff like that. That's not free speech. You want to have a conversation about ideas, but these people are not interested in ideas. They're interested in their own ideas and getting people to accept those ideas as fact when they're actually not. That is that people who think they're white should run the world and everybody else should take a back seat and let them dominate. And that's what they do. So it's really not about free speech at all. So, as a matter of fact, they have no respect for my free speech, obviously. Anybody who is like me, like Zandra Robinson, Steve Salida, or Tianga Yamada Taylor, I mean, they have no respect for people like us, with our opinion. As a matter of fact, they want to stop us from talking because we challenge what they do. And the key is that we can't see, we can't stop talking about this. We got to continue to confront and to challenge those ideas.
And what was the college administration's response?
Well, the response was, after having a conversation with me, the president told me in that conversation that she supported everything that I was saying in the Facebook post, but she just didn't like the hashtag that let them fucking die, right? And she said she found that to be reprehensible. And I was like, do you understand what a hashtag is? I mean, on a conversation, it's also a citation. You know, it's not what you think. And so her response was to release a statement saying exactly that, that my use of the hashtag and the words that I use were reprehensible, and that Trinity supports all, you know, cultures and so forth, right? And respectability discourse and civility thing that she was laying out. And they wanted to know if I had violated any college rules or community standards and stuff like that, which I knew I hadn't, because my speech was political utterance. It was free speech as well as it was academic freedom. It was my personal Facebook post and my Twitter account, so they have no authority in that arena in the first place, as far as I'm concerned. And so she did that. That then fueled more death threats towards me and my family. It got worse. And then they came out with a second statement some days later where it got even worse again, where they said effective immediately I was put on involuntary leave. I didn't accept the leave, and I challenged it, and my colleagues on the campus were with me. We challenged it. And alumni challenged it with me. I had a whole bunch of alumni behind me, which I was thoroughly pleased with. And I was actually kind of shocked that alumni was supportive of me. But so Trinity isn't as conservative as I thought it was. And then the support of my colleagues internationally as well as nationally was very heartening. And so all that pressure coming to bear in letter writing and petitions and so forth. And after this review by the dean of the college, which it was not a faculty sanctioned review because we govern ourselves, faculty governance. And so it was illegal as far as the faculty were concerned. The dean said that I had done nothing wrong. So, but yet and still, when she issued the statement where I had done nothing wrong, that we had mutually consented to go on voluntary leave, I had mutually consented to that.
But you had not consented to it, certainly not originally.
Not originally. No, I had not. The school was concerned about the bottom line, quite frankly, because these colleges, especially private schools, depend on these donations and the endowments. And they were concerned about that. They don't want professors to say anything that is controversial that will upset them making money, adding money to the endowment. That's their primary focus. It wasn't with me. It wasn't with my family. As far as I know, the president has never of the college ever called me and said, how are you doing personally and how's your family doing? And I hope you all are doing well. None of that has never occurred. I've never received an apology or anything, even after the fact of this illegal kind of review that they did. So it's been one mess. It's ongoing. I still receive threats. I received a threat just the other day on my phone from someone telling me, oh, you want to kill white people? Well, what if I kill you? Stuff like that. You know, so it never stops. And somewhat I'm used to it because of my involvement with Palestinian issues. I was receiving death threats from Zionists. But this was like on par, way more than I never had this kind of experience. And that's because, as you said, it was a coordinated strike. It's a targeting mechanism. They're targeting people.
So what is the lesson in this? Some would say that black folks really have no interest in advocating bans on so-called hate speech or prohibitions against all kinds of speech because they will ultimately be used against us selectively.
Yes, and the ultimate lesson, I guess, about that is first of all, I don't understand hate speech. I don't get that. But there are limitations already within academic freedom as well as free speech as to what is not free speech. And we know what that is. When you incite violence, it's not. Another thing is that we may have academic freedom in free speech, but when we seek to exercise that as a faculty of color, right, as faculty who are on the left, when we want to exercise academic freedom in free speech, then we find out that we don't have that right to exercise it. So that goes on too, because then we challenge the dominant ways of being and thinking about the world. That is, this oppressive, white supremacist, capitalist environment that we're in doesn't want you to think outside of that box. They want you to think that that is the order of the world, the way things should be. So when you challenge that, then they say, oh, you don't have free speech. You have free speech as long as you support that kind of oppressive system. And that's what I learned from this. And so what I'm doing is trying to practice it. These are not just grandiose ideas.
Yes. A person, a professor, or anyone from any walk of life can celebrate Columbus Day and not be seen as reprehensible, despite the fact that Christopher Columbus personally and as a commander took slaves and murdered people and invaded their territory and committed huge crimes. And yet, if you advocated or if you said that you thought it would have been best if the Native Americans killed every settler as they set foot on Western Hemisphere soil, you'd be described as advocating something quite hateful.
Yes. I mean, and that's the double standard, right? I mean, that is the oppressive class, put on a pedestal their leadership, right? And they turn stories around. It's like, say, for instance, I was giving a talk in Canada last week, and this guy from Scotland stood up, and he was talking about, well, you know, when in the 1970s, Chicago and Detroit were the capital murders of the world and stuff like that. I said, you know, after he got through talking and doing this spiel about Chicago and the cities, you know, usually urban areas, which mean black and Latino, I just said to him, I'm not so much concerned about Chicago and Detroit and places like that because the United States itself is the murder capital of the world. I mean, what we do is kill people. It's a warrior culture. The country's foundation is violence. Yet people don't want to talk about their violent ways, right? We are violent daily against people, not only linguistically, but physically we kill people. When we're not killing each other, we're killing people in the world, or we do it simultaneously. So they don't want to talk about that. They don't want to talk about Christopher Columbus or Thomas Jefferson and the brutality of that, or George Washington in the country's slavery. So when you point that out, you yourself then become the perpetrator. You're not the victim anymore. You're the perpetrator of these guys. I mean, you perpetrate against them. You oppress them because they don't want to hear about it. They want to be comfortable in their oppressive ways. They don't want you pointing it out. You know, so you get this thing that D'Angelo called white fragility. That's what we're experiencing today, too. The people don't want to talk about it. They want to just put their people up and say, you should idolize these folks or take a knee for the national anthem, which is a racist anthem, and the flag itself, which is worse than the Confederate flag for what it represents, the American empire and so forth. So it's those kinds of double standards and things that people don't want to talk about that then retards our ability to take out the oppressive system which we exist within in the United States, in the world.
When will you be returning to your classroom activities?
I will be returning to my classroom activities in January, late January in the spring. So I go back. And I anticipate, I've been on campus anyway. I go on campus on and off because it's just to leave. I'm not prohibited from campus. And I'm involved with a lot of students. Students have me doing a lot of things and stuff. So I'm doing okay. My family has pretty much gotten back to normative ways of being, the way things were before. We're doing family things. But it really did shake up my family. We're better, I think, but we're also very cautious. But it's one thing that I will not do. I will not forsake my obligation to speak about the facts and speak about them with integrity and with truth.
As a sociologist, you teach about things that have to do with race. Your recent experiences should give you more material firsthand.
Yes, I've been giving a lot of talks about this. I'm actually writing a paper about academic freedom and racism in the United States because I am a critical racism scholar, critical white supremacist scholar. And there used to be a time in the United States, as you know, just during the Obama era, just to say the word white supremacy would discombobulate people who identified as white. And that is no longer the case. Now white supremacy is being used, but it is not being used in ways in which talks about the systemic nature of white supremacy, right? And so that's something to talk about because white supremacy is not just something that's in the individual's mind, the individual racist mind. It is a system. It is a culture. It is linguistically oriented. It is all those things and policies and practices which people need to talk about.
That was Professor Johnny Williams on leave of absence from Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. In Philadelphia this past weekend, students from Temple University's Black and Brown Coalition held an all-day conference on Black Panther Party co-founder Huey P. Newton and the struggle for world peace and self-determination. Some of the organizers, like Davia Nair, are also members of the Philadelphia Saturday Free School. Nair spoke on the subject of education for liberation.
This panel is about the role of political education, the struggle against this treacherous system, and what it means to create knowledge that is in service of the people rather than profit, which is the modus operandi of institutions of higher learning, like Temple University, where we are today, and where the Black Panthers gathered in September of 1970 for the Revolutionary People's Convention to demand, quote, freedom of the oppressed poor by the fascist government, unquote. By now, we should all see through the liberal white media's propaganda about fascism as something that originated in November of last year. when we look at the Panthers and Huey Newton were fighting against, it is clear that what white people are now suddenly up in arms about, so-called fascism, is the culmination of a 400-year process rooted in European colonialism and the enslavement of black people. This is how Europe underdeveloped Africa, Asia, and the Americas. And Africa and Asia, as we know from Du Bois's The World in Africa, which we're reading at the Saturday Free School, and of which I'm a very proud member. This is the story of how Europe underdeveloped Africa, and this is a book as well, but the civilizations of Africa and Asia were far more advanced than Europe prior to the 15th and 14th centuries when we begin to see the initial stages of what we have today, which is the late stage of imperialism. So this is how Europe underdeveloped Africa, Asia, and the Americas, and why poverty can continue to maintain its grip on black people and the people of the third world. It is myths such as these that a revolutionary education must dispel, an education that prepares the masses to wage a prolonged struggle, an education that raises the consciousness of the people such that they can no longer ignore the contradictions of this imperialist and white supremacist system. Huey Newton said, quote, that the main purpose of the vanguard group should be to raise the consciousness of the masses through educational programs and other activities. If the party does not make the people aware of the tools and methods of liberation, there will be no means by which the people can mobilize, unquote. It is becoming increasingly clear to the students of all major institutions of secondary and post-secondary learning in America that the school system is designed to preserve the integrity of white people and to divide and conquer black people. the curriculum of white neoliberal institutions like Temple begins with the project of salvaging Europe, of which America was initially a colonial extension. It both encourages and rationalizes the systematic attack on Africans and African-American civilization. Academia, as the conference organizers point out, serves as an extension of state power. However, I would also say that academia not only interferes with the revolutionary process, it is always already preparing itself to defeat it. In fact, in the past 40 years, as we know, the state has devoted immense resources towards repressing and killing anyone who has dared to fight for Black liberation, including our beloved Huey P. Newton, who we are here to remember today. Huey Newton, James Baldwin, W.E.B. Du Bois, Martin Luther King Jr., Bunchy Carter, Fred Hampton, and so many others who gave their lives so that we can be here today, all believed that Black liberation is a necessary prequel to the complete liberation of humanity in the movement of history. It is for this reason that I say that white academia is poised to defeat revolutionary thought. In fact, it is organized around this very principle. This is the position that Huey Newton started from in his 1967 essay, which we're reading on this panel, on the correct handling of a revolution. He said, quote, "If it is learned by the power structure that Black people have X number of guns in their possession, that information will not stimulate the power structure to prepare itself with guns. We must be under no such illusions. The power structure is already prepared. As such, the function of an education that is committed to the liberation of the dark nation," and the dark nations is a concept that Du Bois puts forward in his thinking, which encapsulates the political unity of Pan-Africa and Pan-Asia against Europe and white America. So the function of an education that's committed to the liberation of dark nations, the function of the revolutionary education and education for liberation is to teach by words and actions the correct strategic methods of prolonged resistance. Those are Huey Newton's words. This is also the function of the revolutionary leadership. So in order to understand academia, I think we have to begin with the position that these so-called institutions of higher learning are really think tanks for the ruling class. To put it bluntly, many of the professors who teach at the schools that dominate the city, you know, including Temple, but not limited to Temple, we have Penn, we have Drexel, we have any major institution. Many of these so-called professors of the humanities and the sciences are the architects of the blueprints for the bombs that reign over Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean, and right here in African America. The function of the revolutionary education, an education for liberation, is to teach by words and actions the correct methods of prolonged resistance. Temple University, for example, is a hub for military science. The University of Pennsylvania is home to the Wharton School of Business, which has wreaked havoc on millions of people all over the world, working and poor people all over the world. In the past decade in the United States, Black people have lost their jobs, their homes, and face routine violence at the hands of the police, the prison system, the medical system, as we heard, and all aspects of the white supremacist state, which includes the education system. We must begin with the premise that knowledge produced in such spaces is knowledge that is against the people from its point of inception. As such, we as people must find new ways of practicing knowledge if we are to strive towards a true education, one that is rooted first and foremost in a revolutionary love for the people. I was reading Revolutionary Suicide in preparation for our study, and I came across this chapter, and this entire book is so beautiful, but this chapter especially, I wanted to just read the first section because it is so tied to this question that I think we're asking on this panel about education for liberation and Huey Newton's experience of the school system. I thought we could read closely. So this is chapter 2, and it's titled Losing, and it begins with a quote from Kenneth Clark's book, Dark Ghetto. "The clash of cultures in the classroom is essentially a class war, a socioeconomic and racial warfare being waged on the battleground of our schools,
with middle-class aspiring teachers provided with a powerful arsenal of half-truths, prejudices, and rationalizations arrayed against hopelessly outclassed working-class youngsters. This is an uneven balance, particularly since, like most battles, it comes under the guise of righteousness. And this is from Kenneth Clark. And Huey draws on this to preface his chapter. He begins, "Because we moved around a lot when I was growing up, I attended almost every grammar and junior high school in the city of Oakland and had wide experience with the kind of education Oakland offers its poor people. At the time, I did not understand the size or seriousness of the school system's assault on black people. I knew only that I constantly felt uncomfortable and ashamed of being black. This feeling followed me everywhere without let up. It was a result of the implicit understanding in the system that whites were smart and blacks were stupid. Anything presented as good was always white, even the stories teachers gave us to read in the early grades, like Black Sambo, Little Red Riding Hood, and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs told us we were. I remember my reaction to Little Black Sambo. Sambo was, first of all, a coward. When confronted by tigers, he gave up the presents from his father without a struggle. First the umbrella, then the beautiful crimson felt-lined shoes, everything until he had nothing left. And afterward, Sambo only wanted to eat pancakes. He was totally unlike the courageous white knight who rescued Sleeping Beauty. The knight was our symbol of purity, while Sambo stood for humiliation and gluttony. Time after time, we heard the story of Little Black Sambo. We did not want to laugh, but finally we did, to hide our shame, accepting Sambo as a symbol of what blackness was all about. We simply did not feel capable of learning what the white kids could learn. From the beginning, everyone, including us, judged smart blacks in terms of how they compared with whites, whether they could read or do arithmetic as well as the white kids. Whites were the standard of comparison in all things, even personal attractiveness. By the third or fourth grade, when we began to do simple mathematics, I had learned to maneuver my way around the teachers. It was a simple matter to put pressure on the white kids to do my arithmetic and spelling assignments. The feeling that we could not learn this material was a general attitude amongst black children in every public school I ever attended. Predictably, this sense of despair and futility led us into rebellious attitudes. Rebellion was the only way we knew to cope with the suffocating, repressive atmosphere that undermined our confidence." So I just want to stop there. Reading that section to me was so powerful and spoke so much to, I think, the realities that students face today. As he wrote in a chapter titled Loving in his magnificent work, Revolutionary Suicide, "In the party, we have formed a family, a fighting family, that is a vital unit in itself. We have no romantic and fictional notions about getting married and living happily ever after behind a white picket fence. We chose to live together for a common purpose, and together we fight for existence and our goals. Today, we have the closeness, the harmony, and the freedom we have sought so long. I am grateful that Huey does not idealize love. Rather, he sees it as a human exchange full of contradictions and something that needs to be worked through. And anything human, as we know, is bound to be imperfect. The great hope of his theory of revolutionary suicide is its grounding in the philosophy of a deep love for humanity, which is the key force for maintaining the momentum of any protracted struggle for freedom." Thank you.
Elias Gonzalez also spoke at the panel on Education for Liberation. Gonzalez said he learned something early on when he joined the Philadelphia Free School 2 years ago.
Education in Black America is synonymous with community empowerment. Education in white America is synonymous with indoctrinization. As Huey found, and as I have found, and as a countless number of others who are unjustly indebted to private and federal loans have found, the universities have failed almost purposely to prepare anyone properly for the tools to understand, overcome, and transform humanity. By mentally destroying and incapacitating us, they sterilize the mind. For the average person, the price is too high. The investment is not enough, and that little sheet of paper matters little. For those that make the mark, the investment requires more than you bargained for. No longer are you a person, but a brand at every corner. Where you come from has turned into what's your background. And what you've gone through becomes your leverage. Where does that leave the invested? It leaves them unable to accept the reality bestowed upon them. They cannot and will not accept the truth. As Du Bois says, they are stuck in the syllogism of the satisfied. Quote, and this is them. This cannot be true. This is not true. If it were true, I would not believe it. If it is true, I do not believe it. Therefore, it is false. That's the mindset they go under. The Black Panther Party was clear which education they were about and for whom. As we have seen displayed so phenomenally throughout this conference, community engagement was central to the Black Panther Party's mission. When Huey envisioned the party, he at first may have seen a nationalist movement, but as he grew, he saw the importance of what he called revolutionary intercommunalism, and what we've been talking about all day today, or the principled unity of the communities throughout the world against the common enemy of white supremacy. Huey credits his ideology to Malcolm X, a man who had educated himself in prison and became, to the white world, one of the most infamous civil rights leaders. To Black America, he was an exceptionally principled, disciplined, and fearless leader of the plight for human liberation. The most important aspect of the development of Huey and Malcolm's ideology is their self-education. In the same vein of Comrade George Jackson, through readings, they could see that the world could be viewed critically, historically, and synthetically. Huey understood this, and when conceptualizing the 10-point program, education of the masses was crucial, when he stated in point number 5, "We want education for our people that exposes the true nature of this decadent American society. We want education that teaches our true history and our role in present-day society." As the Panthers understood it, white supremacy was not an individual attack upon the darker people of America, but a system that diminished the humanity and livelihood of this specific community. Black and working class Americans were at the very bottom of the system. They held the entirety of white supremacy together, but it is at the cost of their labor, humanity, and self-determination that all these establishments are built upon. They understood themselves and the community they served as a forefront for liberation of all those affected by the white supremacist system. In order to arm themselves, they took up the gun, and most importantly, the book, as Huey also states. So therefore, and in my experience, I've come to the conclusion that appealing to those adamantly invested in academics proves difficult, for their minds have been made up and their investment has been made. They are meant to be scholars, scientists, philosophers. However, all they have become are purveyors of white supremacy. Here at Temple University, the African American Studies Department and Afrocology is riddled with purveyors of white supremacy. The works and accomplishments of the Black Panther Party are held in whispers between those curious enough to research outside the box. The crucial contributions and ideology of W.E.B. Du Bois are kept silent under the condemning and erasing guise of identity politics. Instead, the focus is on the coulda, woulda, shoulda, and not on what is. The revolution is what's happening, and the work that needs to take place is what needs to be done. Now, education provides the tools to help solve bigger problems, and the biggest problem now is the illiteracy, forced ignorance, and systematic oppression of Black America by white America. The Black Panther Party already identified the problem. They conceptualized solutions and proved that the power of the people is the biggest threat to white America. They showed what it means to be armed with books, ideology, and love for humanity, and what that could mean for them. They showed us what it means to be Black, what it means to be human, because to be Black is to be human.
That was Elias Gonzalez speaking at a conference on the late Black Panther Party leader Huey P. Newton at Temple University in Philadelphia. Christy Love is a New York City area DJ and political activist who recently returned from a 10-day trip to Israeli-occupied Palestine. DJ Christy Love reported back to Existence for Resistance, one of the organizations that made her trip in solidarity with Palestinians possible. Christy Love told Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier what she learned about the day-to-day lives of Palestinians.
The experience as a whole, when people ask me about the trip, how was the trip? And I have the same reaction every time, whereas it's hard to kind of put it into like a small sentence or one word. You know, it was amazing and it was beautiful, but it was also very stressful and very emotional and quite sad a lot of times because of the day-to-day. And, you know, we stayed at a refugee camp pretty much the entire time that we were there for 2 weeks. So we definitely got a chance to experience how it was on the day-to-day. And I mean, just for me, and I'm a visitor, I can't even imagine living there day-to-day with the amount of anxiety that I even had and stress just because, you know, to go from, you know, one town or village to the next, there are checkpoints everywhere. And a very much, I don't even want to say police presence because it's not even police there, it's mostly military. So there's a very heavy military presence there that we are not really familiar with here in the States. The heavy military, the military presence was probably the most disconcerting thing. And just to know that they have to go through that questioning and that checking and the checkpoint and the constant, let me see your papers, let me see your passport, let me see, you know, where are you going, where are you coming from, who do you know here, where, you know, why are you going there? I mean, and that's not something, I mean, we have that, the level of stop and frisk here. That's probably what I would equate it to. But the day-to-day is stop and frisk on steroids. So just the regulations and the daily restrictions, I will say, put on Arabs in general, in, I guess, quote unquote, Israel, what they want to call it, that was very stressful, very stressful. Because you can't just ride, you know, from here to there, get in your car like we do. So that was very stressful because we were in the West Bank a lot. We were in areas that they discourage anyone from going to because, you know, they want to spread a message, oh, come to Israel, it's this tourist paradise, when, you know, that only exists if you stay in the bubble of Tel Aviv, you know what I mean? And even then, there's heavy military presence. It's just the IDF instead of the Palestinian Authority. So very stressful, but so many beautiful times as well, and it's a beautiful country. So it's like a constant, it's a constant emotional balance that you have to strike.
And you mentioned the picture that those that run the 48 or Israel try to present to the rest of the world. Could you elaborate a little bit on that? And could you discuss BDS and, you know, your thoughts on the BDS efforts, your thoughts on that movement before and after your trip to Palestine?
Right. Well, this is the thing. So prior to that, my only knowledge of that in detail was really through Nancy, who is one of the co-founders of Existence is Resistance. Because, you know, we would be here, you know, going, you know, hanging out, or, you know, we might go to dinner. And it's like I would always get a little frustrated because she was always wondering, is this place Israeli? Do they support Israel? You know, then I don't want to spend my money here. So I'll say prior to the trip, I had very little understanding of how much our money as Americans fund what's going on over there. So now after the trip, I'm fully understanding and fully aware and fully supportive. There's nothing I can do about my paycheck and the tax dollars that come out of my paycheck, but I can do something about the money that I spend on a daily basis. Just the fact that the U.S. spends $10 million a day financing the genocide that's going on over there, you have to do your part and take a stand and not support it any further.
And if I recall from the report back, you had your room shot into, is that correct?
Yeah, that was prior to, you know, us coming there, but you could see the evidence of it. So that was a little, you know, that's like day one in the refugee camp. But, and we stayed at a guest house you know, that's within the cultural center there within the camp. And we got a chance to work with the kids, which was, that was life-changing. That really was a big life-changing part of the trip. But yeah, when we first got there that first night, I remember looking up in the ceiling like, all righty, so clearly, you know, shots get fired here. And these aren't small bullets or small guns. So yeah, we definitely did experience some gunfire while we were there. Nothing on the scale that the room showed as far as bullets coming into the center, but you could hear late at night, you know, gunfire being exchanged between either the IDF or Palestinian Authority, you know, with the resistance within the camp. So, yeah, that, you know, unless you're from, and even if you're from a certain neighborhood or, you know, a poorer neighborhood and, you know, they might exchange gunfire, you have never heard gunfire like this before. Never in your life. Unless you've been to war, Afghanistan. I mean, this is like heavy artillery.
Before the Palestine trip, you DJed for a fundraising event for the families that have been raided by these various law enforcement agencies over the past few years, especially in New York City. I'm just wondering if you could kind of speak to that and the connections around militarized police occupation and racialization and terrorism that's brought upon these communities.
Right, and it's, you know, when you think about it being applied to all people, indigenous people who, meaning the powers that be, that come in and try to take over an area, take over a land, take over a resource from a people, and they institute that military rule over those people. So at any time, I can stop you, I can question you, I can plant evidence, I can make it seem as if I needed to handle you in a certain way. I can arrest you, I can arrest your family, I can terrorize your village. That is the level that it's on. Versus here, they can stop you, they frisk you, they take you in, they can arrest you, find reasons, release you. We have some sort of judicial process, some semblance of it, I will say that. Which, I mean, it fails us here. I mean, look at Khalid Browder. I mean, that's the judicial process here. So these are the same things that are happening there. People being pulled in for questioning and being locked up, and they can renew that every, I want to say, 90 days. Oh, we still need to question. We still need to question. That can go on for over a decade. So it's still the same pressure being applied to a group of people to terrorize them.
Another theme that was definitely repeated and seemed to pervade the discussion at the report back is this question of culture and, you know, the cultural health of the Palestinian community as you saw it, and these assaults upon Palestinian culture, especially from your vantage point as a DJ. What were some of the cultural expressions that you recognized in Palestine compared to here in the States, and how is it that you saw Palestinians attempting to maintain their culture in the face of this terrorism?
Well, I will say one advantage that they do have that black and brown people don't have here in the States, whereas this is somewhat a less than 100 years conflict and occupation. So they still have a huge sense of self, a huge sense of self-love for their community. They're still very much tight-knit, versus in the States, there's been a systematic over hundreds and hundreds of years, you know, to strip a people of their heritage so that they are divided. So I will say that taught me a lot about unity, about not letting division take place, about educating yourself about your history so that you have pride in yourself, pride in your people, pride in where you come from. And I think that brings, when you have that brings unity in the struggles that we face. Because you have to think, we have Black Lives Matter and all of these movements that go on in the States, but what we lack is a general knowledge of self, which is what unites Palestinians. You know, they teach their children about their father and their grandfather and their great-grandfather and the land and where they live and where they're from. You know, they might not have been there yet, but they know where it's at and they're fully aware. So that unity and that love and that pride in their land, where they come from, and the knowledge that, you know, we are in a tough situation now, we are going through hardship now, there's an active genocide against us now, but someday we will have our land back.
Now, of course, this was a snapshot of Palestinian life, but I'm wondering if you, during those 10 days, were able to find some examples of Palestinian music that you were able to relate to.
Oh my gosh, I actually wish that I had more time there to devote to just the music scene there. I met so many different Palestinian artists, rappers, singers. I had a chance to witness a Palestinian rapper freestyle at one cultural center over some beats that we had brought, which was really, really dope. But then mostly the kids, the young artists that are up and coming, and just getting to witness them rap about kids not smoking, because there's a big population. I mean, you have to imagine the stress that they encounter and that they go through daily. There are a lot of children that smoke cigarettes there. So it was just really heartwarming to see other teenagers and kids rapping about the dangers of smoking and how, you know, it's not cool to smoke. And all the kids are very aware of their heritage, so they sing and rap about that. You know, we asked them to do art projects, and they all are doing the same project and the same theme about Free Palestine. So it's a constant, constant theme, even within the music and the art. And that's so dope. It's like such a common message. I wish next time I would like to work more and do more like concerts and let them have the ability to showcase their talents while we're there. And then you have to realize social media is still very new over there. You know what I mean? Facebook and all these things. So they haven't had access to a lot of the influences that we've had, but the talent and the skill is definitely there. You know, I didn't see any type of corporatization going on at all with it. There's still a lot of freedom with how they're expressing themselves. But at the same time, you have to realize their Facebook accounts are watched, their Instagram, all of that is very much watched. So I'm sure they have to be careful about the material that they post.
So finally, would you go back to Palestine, to the regions that you visited and others, and why, in your view, should we make sure to get out to Palestine to see for ourselves what's going on there?
I definitely want to go back, and I definitely would want to go back as an organizer next time as well, just because I feel like now that I've been once, I have like that inside track. I don't know, it's hard. In life in general, you won't know about anything until you see for yourself and investigate for yourself. If you allow Facebook to be your news source, or, you know, sources that aren't trusted, the regular news media, of course, we all know they only show us what the government wants us to know. So I feel like going there and seeing for myself with my own eyes, experiencing the stress, experiencing the sadness, the tears that I cried. I mean, those are things that stay with you forever. Talking with families, working with the kids. These are the only way that you will know what's really going on in different regions of the world. I mean, that's just what it is. And that knowledge has changed me. Totally changed me, you know, coming back, and changed my entire outlook on what's going on over there, because now I feel like I know the truth. I don't know some manufactured version or propaganda story. I know the exact truth about what's going on. And you can't do anything about something until you get riled up, until you are shaken up emotionally, until you talk to a family whose child was murdered before their eyes by Israeli settlers from Brooklyn. You know what I mean? So these are things that stick with you, and these are things that put you and spur you into action. And I think everybody needs to do that. Because especially in the States, we get very complacent, and we're all in our own bubble here. So I feel like you have to get out of that to see what's going on around you, to see the suffering that's going on around you. Because as long as someone's not free here, or there's strife here, or there's an occupation there, none of us are free. We're all one.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.